Good evening, friends, brothers and sisters. I seem to be a little parched tonight, and I shall probably be even more in trouble by the time I get through inhaling the perfume from these flowers for very long.
Would you like me to move?
No, it's all right. It's all right. It's a good excuse. Thank you. About the first thing I notice when I stagger from my bed to my bathroom each morning, having skillfully avoided looking into the mirror, I notice three calendars. The first one has little squares on it on which I can write my commitments for the day. Happily, most of those squares are blank. But the second one is a Bible trivia calendar, and each day has a question and an answer. The problem was, when I bought this, I didn't realize that it was a perpetual calendar and therefore only had the numbers of the days and not the name of the days. And I need all the help I can get to orient myself first thing in the morning, so I had to buy another calendar. And it has a Bible quotation with a little suitable homily along with it. But in the course of trying to answer the trivia questions from the Bible, I discovered I wasn't as well versed on scripture facts as I thought I was, because so far I'm only averaging 2 out of 3 correct answers on this thing. And most of the trouble I have is with names. I can remember the incidents, but I can't really attach the name of the person involved or who said the quote. For example, what man, a Horonite, opposed Nehemiah and Jews rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem? And the answer to that is Sanballat, which I didn't get. Name the city where King Ahasuerus had his throne, Susa or Shushan, I didn't get that either. And who first used the quote, the words, skin of my teeth, having escaped by the skin of my teeth? And then the answer to that is Job. And I didn't get that one either. That was today's. So I decided character studies may help me to remember those who, to my mind, are relatively obscure characters in Scripture. And I'm hoping that you'll learn something tonight, or at the very least be reminded of things you already know. I think most of you know that my pet hobby horse is trying to relate the ordinary humanness of Bible characters to those who find themselves in extraordinary situations, and because of that, play some part, either small, medium, or large, in the plan and purpose of God. Well, tonight, I'm going to study some of what I would call the little people. For example, in Genesis, we find, to my surprise, there are 2 Lamechs. One, according to Genesis 4, verse 18, is the 6th generation descendant from Cain. Now, that Lamech seems to have inherited the same propensities toward violence as did his ancestor Cain. In Genesis 4, verses 23 and 24, we find a pretty good indication of the character of this particular Lamech. This is the first poetry recorded in Scripture, and became known as the Song of the Sword. Now, as a budding poet, Lamech could have chosen any subject that he liked upon which to write his verse and his thoughts. He could have written about his love for his wife or his family or the wonders of creation or future hopes. But instead, he wrote a poem about brutality and bloodlust. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Hear my voice, wives of Lamech. Listen to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. So, whereas Cain had killed Abel in a coldly calculated way, motivated by jealousy, Lamech appears to have killed out of pride, or to prove that he could. And he demonstrates that anyone inflicting even the slightest wound on him can expect to pay the ultimate price. Lamech, in his poem, appears to be trying to justify the killings as self-defense. And in that way, of course, he might escape the vengeful relatives of his victims. As we all know, life was cheap in those days before the flood. Violence and corruption were general. Only a few, such as Abel, Seth, and Noah, did well in the eyes of God. Lamech the first, then, was a true child of Cain. He had no hesitation in ignoring the principles spelt out by God to the first human pair. In Genesis 2, verses 22 to 24, it's recorded how God, having created Eve, brought her to Adam and stated how a man shall be joined to his wife, singular, and become one flesh. Lamech demonstrated his disdain for that principle by becoming the first bigamist recorded in Scripture. And although there's no doubt that in that society, the way we remember this Scripture describes it, that there were many more who did the same and perhaps even were polygamists. But Lamech the first had two wives then, as we've already read, Ada and Zillah. Ada, meaning deposed, was the mother of Jabal, who was to become a nomadic farmer and shepherd. Ada was also the mother of Jubal, who was more artistic and credited with introducing musical instruments such as the harp and pipe. That trait must have been surely inherited from his mother's side of the family, certainly not his father's, I would think. Zillah, wife number two, whose name means shaded or shadowed, also had two children. The boy was obviously named to give glory to his ancestor Cain, since he was called Tubal-Cain, and yet another indication of the disdain Lamech I had for God. Tubal-Cain's talent lay in the field of metalwork, which of course included the manufacture and design of weapons, which would suit his father down to the ground. Lamech also had a daughter by Zillah, and she was called Naamah, and her name means beautiful and pleasurable. Now, as with all ancient Bible stories, Jewish oral traditional stories are eventually recorded in the Midrash, and they flesh out what are often the bare bones of the Scripture narrative. They're not as reliable as the inspired Scripture, of course, and in case you're not familiar with the term Midrash, it's a traditional commentary by rabbis and other students on the Hebrew texts. And so we can be guided by them, but we certainly don't treat them as being inspired as Scripture is inspired. But they often help in helping us understand the prevailing conditions and attitudes of the society and the people of those times. In this case, Lamech the first, the suggestion is that he set himself up as judge and jury and executioner and set himself up almost as a god. And they contend that Ada was his true wife and that she was deposed, as her name means, when Zillah, wife number two, came on the scene. Zillah, again meaning shaded, shadowed, or dark, was shaded and protected by Lamech. Now, the Midrash goes on to suggest that the offspring of Ada were more godly than those of Zillah, who followed closer to their father's footsteps. Tubal Cain is credited with having invented the sword, and Sister Niama's name, Pleasurable, is due to her singing and performing in praise of idols. Now, as I've attempted to point out on previous occasions, many of the meanings given to names are definitions earned by the individuals as life progressed, rather than what the name meant when it was originally given to them. And again, the Midrash includes a story which I must say is more, I think, composed on the basis of the need for poetic justice than it is of an accurately recorded historical fact, but it claims that Lamech, with eyesight now dimming, and being still the avid hunter that he always was, and armed with Tubal Cain-designed deadly steel-tipped arrow, shot at a moving target, only to discover that he had killed his fugitive ancestor, Cain. When he realized what he had done, he turned the weapon on his son, Tubal Cain, because he had made the arrow that killed Cain. And we're told from that day forth, both Adah and Zillah spurned Lamech. Now, I recognize that that sounds more like the plot of a Hollywood movie than it does scripture, but many Orthodox Jews believe that to be true. All the descendants of Cain, of course, including Lamech the first, would have died in the flood if not before. By contrast, Lamech the second is interesting in that at 182 years old, he sired a son, Noah. And based on scripture chronology, Lamech the second lived for 777 years. Now, as we know, seven in scripture represents completeness or perfection, so Lamech the second must have had divine approval for something. Remarkably, Lamech the second lived to within 5 years of the deluge, so he was not killed by the flood. He died before it. And it appears Methuselah, the longest living human, was the last of the line of the righteous Seth to die before the flood. And as we know, only Noah and his family survived the flood to fulfill the command to replenish the earth, as shown in Luke 3, verses 37 and 38. There's a partial genealogy, and that includes Lamech's name. And that is, of course, Lamech too, who was so amazingly different in character from the godless and reprehensible Lamech the first. The next characters are two brothers who are presented in scripture as total opposites. They were two sons of Leah, Reuben and Simeon. Reuben was Jacob's first son, therefore destined to be special to his father. But the trouble was, he was the son of Leah, the unloved first wife of Jacob. Leah, you may remember, was foisted off on Jacob by the deceitfulness of Jacob's unscrupulous father-in-law, Laban. Reuben should have had all the customary advantages of the firstborn, but judging by the Bible narrative, Reuben appears to have been far more devoted to Leah than to Jacob, and vice versa. Leah produced sons on a regular basis, and normally that would endear her to her husband, because, of course, sons were very welcome and were far more valuable than daughters. So Leah had four sons before she became infertile. Meanwhile, Jacob's second wife, Rachel, for whom he had worked an extra 7 years, you remember, for Laban, produced no children at all, although she was Jacob's much-loved favorite, and I'm sure that the lack of children wasn't for the lack of trying. Not surprisingly, Rachel was jealous of Leah, and She was jealous because of her productivity. Leah was jealous of Rachel because she was Jacob's favorite. So, as we see so often in Scripture, and perhaps in our own lives too, when God doesn't give us what we want or think we deserve, faith tends to fly out the window and our own plans kick in. And in Rachel's case, she resorts to chicanery, planning to get children she can call her own by using a surrogate mother, her slave Bilhah. Seeing what was going on, the infertile Leah decides that what's good enough for Rachel is good enough for her, so she presents her slave Zilpah to Jacob, and that works well, producing son number 5, and one whom Leah can call her own. Now, presumably, the slave girls didn't have much of a say in this scheme, and there are no complaints recorded from Jacob either. Well, why would he? Reuben, we're told, in Genesis 30, verse 14, went out at a time of the wheat harvest. But instead of coming home with a load of wheat, he searched long and hard and found mandrakes, which were rare and treasured in those days, and he brought them for Leah. Reuben, who by that time would be in his mid-teens, would have known that mandrakes were reputed to have magical powers for fertility. And he brought them to Leah, hoping to see Leah productive again and finally becoming more respected and treasured by Jacob. I can't imagine why Jacob, at the age of 80, would still be wanting more children, when he had at least 8, but apparently he did. And I suppose maybe the figs and olive oil diet had something to do with that, but that's conjecture. Reuben brought the rare mandrakes to Leah, but Rachel saw them and obviously believed in the magical powers of the mandrakes, and she offered Leah the trade of a night of conjugal bliss with Jacob in exchange for the mandrakes. Leah, minus the magical mandrakes, spends the night with Jacob, and lo and behold, she conceives, and her fertility has been restored. Rachel, in spite of all the help she was expecting to get from the mandrakes and believed that they could provide, remains childless for several more years. Later, not because of any mandrakes or any other external aids, but because God heard her prayer, Rachel bears the child who was to become the most famous of all Jacob's children, Joseph. Reuben, in what seems to have been a departure from his usual caring and pacific character, has an affair with Rachel's slave girl, Bilhah. And since Jacob had also had carnal relations with her, Reuben is guilty of defiling his father's bed, as was read in our opening reading. Now, the timing of this incident is interesting. According to the rabbinical historians, as long as Rachel was alive, Jacob always slept in Rachel's tent, while occasionally visiting the other three mothers of his children in theirs. But when Rachel died, Jacob still avoided moving in with his first wife, Leah. Instead, he moved in with Bilhah, the slave. This, we're told, added insult to injury as far as Leah was concerned, and in the eyes of her son, Reuben, who chose in his anger and jealousy to, quote, rumple the sheets of his father's bed, as the Midrash puts it, and so disgrace his father. But Reuben was to pay a high price for his fit of pique eventually, although the scripture doesn't record Jacob as having taken any immediate action against either Reuben or Bilhah. According to the rabbis, Bilhah told Jacob of her experience and was not blamed by Jacob. That incident is recorded in Genesis 35. Now, I get the impression that after that, Reuben became ashamed of what he had done and probably recognized that in disgracing his father, he'd also disgraced himself, and spent the rest of his life trying to redeem himself in the eyes of his father and the community. Now, as with so many blended families we see in our society, Jacob's was, to say the least, dysfunctional. But there was one thing upon which 11 of the sons agreed. They were insanely jealous of Joseph, and there's no doubt that was largely Jacob's fault. Jacob seems to have been incapable of dealing equitably with those close to him, whether it was his wives or his children. Rachel was his undisputed favorite, and her elder son, Joseph, was his favorite too, in spite of the fact that there were several others born before him. Well, we all know how that played out. Joseph made things worse by telling his brothers of his dreams, where he was placed in a position superior to them. And if they were jealous to start with, well, that story tipped them over the edge. And Joseph disappeared, was presumed dead by Jacob, who paid the price of his favoritism by grieving for some 25 years before being reunited in Egypt. Now, of course, we recognize that all these things that are happening are in the plan and purpose of God, but it wasn't necessary that God planned all these things to happen the way they did. God was working out his plan in spite of what the human beings were doing of their own volition. They all had free will. But when we look at Reuben, we find it was Reuben who saved Joseph's life when the others would have happily killed him. And it was Reuben who planned to rescue Joseph from the dry well. And it was Reuben who told his father Jacob that if he, Reuben, did not bring Benjamin safely back from Egypt, Jacob could kill Reuben's two sons. Now, we could suspect that this was an elaborate plot by Reuben trying to curry favor with Jacob as a means to redeeming himself and regaining any lost reputation that he had. But I believe that Reuben was now a mature man and not an angry and vengeful teenager anymore, and that he had grown in character, and having seen Jacob's grief over the loss of Joseph, softened in his attitude toward his father. If I'm wrong, and Reuben was attempting to ingratiate himself with his father, it didn't work. When Jacob lay dying, as we read in Genesis 49, verses 1 to 4, he seems to have acknowledged Reuben's strengths and good qualities, but it's clear from his later comments the memory of having been cuckolded by Reuben over 20 years earlier still rankled. Genesis 49, verses 1 to 4 are recorded this way by one Jewish commentator. "You are my firstborn, and hence you should have been privileged over your brothers with my strength and the first of my wealth, and you should have had more strength to rule over your brothers. But you were rash and impetuous like spilling water, and therefore you shall excel no longer. Neither have the rights of the firstborn nor sovereignty, for you mounted your father's bed." And in Chronicles, it says, "Reuben defiled his father's bed. His birthright was given to the sons of Joseph of Israel, so he is not reckoned as a firstborn in the genealogy, although Judah became more powerful than his brothers and a leader came from him, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph." Now, when the Israelites were taking over the promised land, the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh requested land on the east side of the Jordan River. And it's suggested that this reflected their attitudes of me first, and I'd rather be by myself than with the rest of the tribes. staying on the east side of the Jordan was always a psychological as well as a physical divide between them and their brother tribes. And no doubt, down through the years, the Reubenites continued to dream of the power and glory that could have been theirs if Reuben had not made that awful mistake. Reuben and his immediate descendants had leadership abilities, creativity, strength, compassion, and perhaps other strong character traits, but those traits were undermined by Reuben's instability, willful self-seeking, pride, and jealousy. And jealousy and pride were not, and are not, confined to Reubenites. They're among the most common traits of humanity, and they're not unheard of, even among Christadelphians. Jealousy and pride are powerful forces. Proverbs 6, verse 34 says, "For jealousy makes a man furious, and he will not spare when he takes revenge." Song of Solomon says, "Jealousy is as cruel as the grave." And with regard to pride, Proverbs 29 says, "A man's pride will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor." Jealousy and pride are traits for all disciples to guard against. Simeon is opposite in character from his brother Reuben. Simeon loved to fight. He and his tribe spent much of their time picking fights. Judges 1 lists a whole host of their bloodthirsty exploits. Simeon's birth was, of course, welcomed by Leah because with the birth of each boy child, she thought that she would gain more value in Jacob's eyes, especially while Rachel remained childless. It was a forlorn hope. Jacob remained unmoved. In Genesis 34, we have stories of one family catastrophe after another. First, Dinah, Jacob's daughter by Leah, is dishonored by Shechem, son of Hamor, king of the Hivites. But apparently, it wasn't a crime of opportunistic, uncontrolled passion. The narrative indicates that Shechem had had his eye on Dinah for quite some time and had actually really fallen in love with her. And, in fact, they were probably well known to each other. Shechem would also know that under normal circumstances, Dinah would be beyond his reach because, as a woman of such a prominent Hebrew family, she would not be allowed to marry a Hivite. Hence the plot to dishonor her, to make her unacceptable to any godly Hebrew. But notice the Bible, most translations, don't say that he raped her, as they do in the case of Tamar, Absalom's sister. The original word translated dishonored would be better rendered humbled. And what the suggestion is that Shechem humbled her by making her ritually unclean. Another important point to remember, according to Genesis 34, verse 1, it indicates that Dinah was out on the town consorting with, quote, the daughters of the land. Well, where the daughters of the land go, the sons of the land are sure to follow, and Shechem and Dinah may have colluded with each other to devise this scheme. Many commentators agree she would not have been in the place she was doing the things she was doing if she'd been devoted to godly principles. Now remember, the Mosaic law was not in existence at this time, and intermarriage was common, but the big difference was, whereas Hebrew men often took wives of their choosing, Hebrew women who married foreigners were outcasts. Shechem freely confesses to his father Hamor of his love for Dinah and asks his father to make a deal with Jacob to allow them to marry. Now, there's no question of Jacob being asked for a dowry for the privilege of his daughter marrying Prince Shechem, as would normally be the case. Hamor is willing to do anything in his power to gain Dinah for Shechem and puts no limits on Jacob's demand. I find it interesting that Jacob, this giant of Scripture, doesn't register any displeasure, even objection toward Dinah, Shechem, or Hamor, but starts negotiations. However, Shechem and Hamor had no idea of the fate that Simeon was planning not only for them, but all the other males of the city. Now, of course, we still hear about honor killings in the Middle Eastern and Asian communities, but Simeon went far beyond the norm. We all know the story of how an agreement was made that all the males would be circumcised, and then if that happened, Dinah would be given in marriage to Shechem. And this was agreed. But while the Hivites were recovering from the operation, Simeon and Levi slaughtered them all and took Dinah back home. Notice, Dinah was taken back home. The deal had been made. Some commentators say that Simeon, although young, was extremely strong and a very experienced warrior who loved to fight and kill, and that he did the slaughter alone, and that his brothers followed after him to plunder and take the booty. This was done without Jacob's knowledge, of course, and when he found out, not only was he livid, but he was afraid, prophesying his house would be destroyed. Obviously, Jacob forgot or momentarily lost faith in God's promise to his forefathers. But soon after, he would have been reminded of it when God changed Jacob's name to Israel and renewed his previous promises. Meanwhile, Simeon continued to be his pugnacious, merciless self, which, as I said at the start of this character study, is very much different from that of his loving, caring brother Reuben. Now, Simeon's name crops up again in Genesis 42, verse 24, when the brothers seek for corn in Egypt, not knowing, of course, that Joseph, by this time not dead, is in a position of power second only to Pharaoh. Joseph decides to hold one brother hostage until they return with Benjamin, the youngest of the brothers. The hostage he chose was Simeon. Jewish tradition has it that Joseph chose him because he was the instigator of the plot to kill Joseph so many years before. It also says it took 7 Egyptian guards to subdue Simeon and bind him, such was his fury and strength. Simeon is eventually released and probably hated Joseph all the more for humiliating him and forcing him to bow before him as Joseph had foreseen in his dreams. And Joseph's power and position would be like rubbing salt into Simeon's wounded pride. Simeon continued to fight his way through his life, as Judges 1 makes clear. And nothing much then is heard about Simeon until Jacob is on his deathbed and he prophesies by way of blessings and cursings what is in store for his sons. He had enunciated the strengths and weaknesses of Reuben, as we've already heard, and Reuben's tribe was inferior, producing no notable or outstanding characters. The tribe remained weak and nondescript. But for Simeon and Levi, Jacob prophesied nothing good. In fact, he curses them because they ruined his reputation as a man of his word over the Shechem affair with both his own and surrounding nations. I'm sure that Jacob welcomed his name change to Israel for more reasons than one. In fact, I believe that Simeon and Levi committed the same sin as that for which David was punished so severely. That is, they had given cause to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. I also believe that same sin can overtake any one of us, in many cases without our even realizing it. Jacob's curse in Genesis 49, verses 5 to 7, which we had read as our introductory reading, came to pass, as we see if we read Numbers chapter 1, verse 23, where we see the tribe of Simeon numbered almost 60,000. But within 40 years, according to Numbers 26, verse 14, that number was down by almost two-thirds to only 22,000. As Jacob predicted, the tribe was scattered, first mainly within the tribe of Judah, but by the time the Babylonian captivity ended, the tribe of Simeon had disappeared as an entity, and some say it was assimilated into the European nations for the most part. Interestingly, though, it is still listed as one of the tribes to contribute 12,000 toward the 144,000 chosen in Revelation. As parents, we're often amazed at how different our children are in spite of having the same genes and having been raised together and having been taught the same values. Surely that is nothing new, because I'm sure Leah must have been just as amazed at the peace-loving Reuben compared to the murderous Simeon. Now, I've mentioned this pair of ordinary women in an extraordinary circumstance before, but tonight we'll devote a few more minutes to them. They are Shiphrah and Puah, the midwives who went directly against Pharaoh's command to kill all the male children at the birth stool. Not only did these remarkable women survive their disobedience to the one who had the power of life and death over them, they prospered. And why? Because they feared God more than Pharaoh, who only had the power to kill their bodies, whereas the Almighty had the power to destroy both body and soul in hell, as Matthew 10, verse 28 puts it. Now, let me say at the outset, there's very little recorded in Scripture upon which to base a true character study, but there is much in Jewish traditional history to make these women interesting to me, and I hope to you. What information there is in our Bible is found in Exodus 1 and Exodus 5, and right away a question is raised about the translation. Chapter 1, verse 15, says in both the King James Version and the New King James Version, Shiphrah and Puah were Hebrew women. So the question is, why would Pharaoh be stupid enough to trust the job of killing all Hebrew male babies to God-fearing Hebrew women? The Egyptians had their own midwives who, one might suppose, would be more likely to obey the orders of the Pharaoh and have far less compunction about killing Hebrew children than would Hebrew midwives. And in fact, not only the Jewish Midrash, but also several modern Bible translations say that Shiphrah and Puah, the midwives who helped the Hebrew women, and suggest that the Shiphrah and Puah were Egyptians. This would also explain why the Pharaoh would be likely to believe Shiphrah and Puah when they gave the explanation, or told the lie, as some say, that Shiphrah and Puah said that the Hebrew women were like animals and dropped their children in moments before the midwife had a chance to put the genocidal plan into action. Pharaohs were, at that time and for many centuries, not only the rulers in the state, but also they were worshipped as gods and therefore were in the position of the chief priests. And the Bible and the rabbis contend that out of fear of the exploding population of the Hebrews, Pharaoh issued the command to kill the male children. But he wouldn't say that. As a god himself, he would be more likely to make the official reason that a god, other than himself, was angry with the Egyptians and demanded the sacrifice of the male children to appease him. And that approach, of course, would solve the consciences of the midwives who were to do the sacrificing, and at the same time, the Pharaoh's fear would be concealed. The rabbis also maintained Pharaoh instructed the midwives as to how to avoid missing the critical murderous moment of opportunity before the boy child became separated from its mother. From the Bible text, it's obvious that once the boy was actually born, the death sentence was commuted. Otherwise, it wouldn't have mattered that the women were in labor for moments rather than for hours. Apparently, and I have absolutely no idea whether or not this is a true medical fact, when the Hebrew women were about to give birth, the Pharaoh says, their thighs became cold as the stone of the birthstool through their contractions, and when a male child was about to appear, he would be looking down toward the earth from which he was formed, while a female would be face up, looking toward the rib from which she was created. Now, as I say, I have no idea whether that's right or wrong, but that's what apparently was the instruction given to the midwives. In any case, it's interesting that if this were the instruction given by the Pharaoh, he believed the same story of the creation as we do, as the one recorded in Scripture. Anyway, by using that guide, the midwives would know in time whether to sacrifice the child or not. Now, that particular Pharaoh's thinking was a bit skewed anyway, in my opinion, because a man could have several wives and women could bear many, many children. And so my thinking is that Pharaoh should have killed the girls who were only allowed one husband, and then the numbers of the children would have been far more restricted. Anyway, in spite of Pharaoh's efforts, the Hebrew population continued to explode at a rate alarming to Pharaoh, but perfectly in accord with the plan and purpose of God. And again, not from the Bible, but from the Midrash, it says Shifra and Pua were mother and daughter, and not just midwives, but supervisors of a team of midwives who tended to Hebrew women. And as such, Shifra and Pua not only avoided killing the male children of the women they attended, they also influenced their whole team to do the same. And this also makes sense because Shifra and Pua would only be able to cope with comparatively few births. Now, while in Egypt, no doubt the Hebrew values and lifestyles and worship of one God and their prosperity, that is until the Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph came along, attracted some Egyptians to become proselytes. And it's suggested that Shifra and Pua were among the proselytes. At the same time, many Hebrews were seduced by the excesses and carnal pleasures of the Egyptians and worshipped their gods, as is obvious from Ezekiel 20, verses 6 to 8, and Joshua 24, verse 14. Now, if Shifra and Pua were Egyptian, which seems likely, they would, of course, be among the mixed multitude described in Exodus 12, verse 38, who left Egypt with the children of Israel and be forerunners of such other faithful women proselytes as Rahab and Ruth. But Hebrew or Egyptian, Shifra and Puah have their little place in Scripture for having feared God more than the ultimate mortal power of their day. They are therefore great examples for us to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is that what they did made not a particle of difference to the plan and purpose of God. His plan proceeded on track and on schedule, and would have done even if Shifra and Puah had obeyed Pharaoh's orders to kill the children. The ones to whom it did make a huge difference to their destinies was, of course, Shifra and Puah. Their reward was to be acceptance by the Almighty, to be confirmed by his rewarding them by increasing their progeny. And some believe that Shifra and Puah became matriarchs of priestly and royal households. Whatever the truth of the details, the lesson is clear. When we need to choose between God's way and any other, only God's way can bring an eternal reward.